This is Audible.
Hey everyone, it's me, Allison Rosen. Welcome to my very first audiobook. It is also my first book. And before I get into it, I want to just fill you guys in on the way this book came about. It's kind of a unique story. So I had a humor column for a few years. It was a humor column, but by the end, it got arguably a little bit serious, sort of like the later years of MASH. But after the first year, for my birthday one year, my husband Daniel presented me with a hardbound book that he'd made himself. And I didn't even know that that was a thing that you could do yourself. But he did. He taught himself how to make a book. And it was all the columns that I wrote in the first year that I had the column. And he had illustrated each one. And he said that he gave it to me because he wanted me to realize that I had already written a book, because I've been wanting to write a book. I mean, I've been a published author for years and years, but I've been wanting to write a book for a long time. But the idea of a whole book is daunting to me. So he wanted me to realize, look, you've already written a book. And it was the sweetest, nicest thing. And then the publisher of the column, Creators, decided that they wanted to put it out in book form as well. So here you go. And by the way, if this is your first exposure to this book, this audiobook, please also go buy the actual book and also buy the ebook. And if it comes out in any other formats, I encourage you to get those too. Multiple copies of all of them. Why stop at just one of each, you know? Okay. I think we're ready to move on. Tropical Attire Encouraged and Other Phrases That Scare Me by Allison Rosen. Creators Publishing. For my family. The gift certificate. And the illustration for this one is a stack of books, all of which are actual books that I own. I've misplaced a gift certificate to a jewelry store I don't like, and it's driving me insane. It's only for about $31, not even enough to buy a necklace I don't want, and yet the fact that at one point I had it and now I don't is unacceptable. I want to have my cake and eat it, too. But I don't want to eat it. I just want to know it's there. Granted, it's a cake I don't like, probably something atrocious with gumballs in it, but it's my disgusting cake, and I will rip this house apart until I find it. Part of the problem is this scrap of paper has zigzagged across the country with me for the last 4 years. I've forged a relationship with it, not unlike the one I have with the empty lipstick tubes rolling around my dresser, which turn it into a giant, clattering maraca. I've been hanging on to them for years, because any day now, I may take advantage of the store's eco-incentive of a free lipstick of your choice in exchange for empty tubes. Do you know how many times I've walked past this store wanting to buy lipstick, but unable because it seems foolish to pay for something I could get for free? Once, when I had the kind of time on my hands that unemployment affords, I actually did bring the tubes with me to the store with the intention of trading them in. I would like a free lipstick, I announced victoriously, pushing my greasy booty toward the clerk in a Ziploc bag. Side note, when I say pushing my greasy booty toward the clerk, I just want you to know I'm not talking about my actual butt, which is not greasy. I'm talking about my Ziploc bag full of greasy lipstick tubes, referred to as a booty. Okay then. But there were so many choices. Matte, frost, cream, reds, browns, peaches, maroons, pinks, purples. Of course, I could just buy, correction, choose, my regular. But that would be so boring. This was an opportunity to shake things up, a chance to color outside the lines. After smearing a crayon box's worth of samples on the back of my hand and then trying unsuccessfully to wipe it all off with a tissue, I realized I'd been foolhardy in thinking I could casually make this decision. Plus, I was told that at a different location, you could exchange the tubes for a free eyeshadow. Maybe that was what I really wanted. As an indecisive control freak who's always sure there's something better around the corner, all my lesser qualities had come together at once to leave me paralyzed. Clearly, I should just march right into my bedroom and open up that drawer and throw out all those empty tubes that I'm never going to exchange. They are taking up space, making me feel like a proto-hoarder, and making it impossible for me to buy lipstick without guilt. My luscious pout deserves better. I'm totally going to free myself of these crimson shackles right after I find the gift certificate. Oh God, what if the jewelry store, a pretentious little boutique that sells yoga-inspired charms and doesn't accept returns, which is how I got into this mess to begin with, I exchanged a gift I didn't want for store credit, quit judging me, goes out of business before I've had a chance to remind myself that there's nothing I want there. I'm pretty sure the slip is either tucked into a book for safekeeping or sitting in the pocket of a handbag. I can definitely remember putting it in one of those places. Unfortunately, I can remember each action with equal vividness, which is causing me to regard my own memory in the same circumspect way you view an insincere friend who loves your new hairdo. Clearly, I've left myself no choice but to open and shake every single book I own, including the self-help ones whose spines face the wall, lest a potential suitor stop by unannounced. Granted, turning the spines against the wall paints a potentially worse portrait, one that suggests I don't know how to use a bookshelf. But these are the risks you take, and it's not as if I have any available dresser drawer space. Oh, you're reading What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You About Your Abnormal Pap Smear? I must have you right now, you sexy minx, I cannot imagine anyone ever saying. Or, yes, of course I don't mind if you slip into something more comfortable. I'll just be here, thinking of you and flipping through this well-worn copy of I Hate You, Don't Leave Me. Oh, how cute, you highlighted it. What's that sound? Are you popping popcorn in your dresser? Incidentally, I Hate You, Don't Leave Me is how I feel about the gift certificate, which is why I have to find it, so I can purge my environment of this toxin once and for all. Or slip it into my copy of Clutter's Last Stand. It's time to de-junk your life. So I wrote this before Marie Kondo's, I forget the name of her book, but like the indescribable, I don't know, the whatever, I can't remember magic of tidying up, which is where you go around your house and you touch items, and if they spark joy, you keep them, and if they don't, you thank them for their service, and then you get rid of them. If I had written this when that book was around and popular, I think that probably would have been the one that I would slip this into. But anyway, a few years later now, here and there I will update you guys on the changes that have happened, and I still, truly, still own a Ziploc bag, a dusty, disgusting, probably rancid Ziploc bag filled with gross, empty lipstick tubes. And I don't even know if the store, MAC, by the way, I don't know if they still offer a free lipstick if you turn in lipstick tubes. Probably not. I've probably held on to it for so long that they no longer do this. And just one more thing, and then we're moving on. When I mentioned turning embarrassing books, turning the spine against the wall, and then it looks like you don't know how to read, I recently, someone posted on Instagram, where I spend too much of my time, someone posted a home decorating tip from like some home decorating blog that said that if the color scheme of your book spines doesn't match the color scheme that you're trying to go for in the room, just turn all the spines against the wall and you just have this big, ridiculous looking, beigey, washy, gigantic thing. And the people who posted it were talking about how awful it was. This is a suggestion, but I was ahead of my time. Is adulthood an illusion? And the illustration for this one is my retainer. And it is actually my retainer, which means that when Daniel, and he did this whole book either at his office or late at night, because the whole thing was a surprise. So a lot of these illustrations, he, you know, staged it and then drew it from that. So what this means is that while I was unawares, he got my retainer and also a tube of Clearasil and some anti-gravity moisturizer, which I didn't even know I had. I think it was a sample. And put them together into a cute little still life and then sketched them. So that's what the illustration is. It's my retainer, it's acne cream, and it's anti-aging moisturizer. The other day, while simultaneously plucking gray hairs and applying Zit cream, it occurred to me that I don't really feel like an adult, not in the ways I would have expected. It's not exactly that I feel young. I no longer possess the desire to stay out all hours, the urge to change the world, or the patience to talk on the phone. Those were beaten out of me years ago. And it's not like I feel fresh-faced, dewy, supple, or elastic. My window to have the perfect bikini body closed before it opened, and sometimes my back hurts if I sit in one position for too long. But in terms of things like knowing what to do if my car breaks down, feeling comfortable calling my friends' parents by their first names, and ease with making small talk at dinner parties, fearlessness, you know, the big-ticket adult items, I'm woefully bereft. By my age, my mom had two kids and had put both parents in the ground. I just adopted a puppy, which feels like a huge, scary commitment, and my insurmountable task for the day is to figure out how to return the bra I bought online, because somehow having to pack it back up in the box and then put the right amount of postage on it and find a mailbox seems like a real pain in the butt. Maybe I'll just keep it and hope my chest grows. Knowing how to purchase a properly fitting bra, according to my mother, is not only something you should have mastered by my age, but also a goal and reward in itself. You'll need to have someone size you, she'll admonish. The correct fit makes a world of difference, and it's much more comfortable. I believe her, sort of, but the idea of having a matronly bra specialist get up in my business with a tape measure and various other tools of the trade, a variety of domed objects from melon baller to salad bowl, I have no idea what goes on there, doesn't sound fun at all. It sounds like a gynecologist visit, which, speaking of, I need to schedule one of those. So, instead of availing myself to a pro, I'll continue to make the error of blindly purchasing something that could support a couple oranges for what are more like tangerines. But the more I talk to my friends, some of whom have ill-fitting bras, some of whom don't, I don't discriminate, the more I realize we all feel this way. None of us learned how to be a grown-up. Is it technology that's made us so dependent? I no longer know anyone's phone numbers because they're stored in my phone, which really should be called my text, as that's all I do on it. The notion of trying to schedule lunch with someone who doesn't text or email causes me panic. Remember when people used to make plans by calling you on the phone and asking you questions in real time, which you then had to answer in real time while the other person sat there breathing into a dumbbell-shaped receiver, which was some kind of beige or white monstrosity, attached to the base on the wall by a big, tangled squiggle of a cord? The only benefit of said cord was it provided you with something to do with your hands while being interrogated. But here's the diabolical genius of the cord. No matter how many times you untangled it, by either dramatically yanking the double helix apart as if showing that piece of rubber who's boss, or wrapping it around your fingers and possibly cutting off your circulation in an effort to coax it back into shape, it snapped right back into a tangled mess the minute you turned your back. Left to its own devices, I'm pretty sure it would turn into a dreadlock. But maybe it's overly simplistic to blame our growing almost an adultness on technology. Especially when I took a poll of adults over 30 recently and asked them what age they feel inside, and the answers ranged from 4 to 23. Have we all been hoodwinked into buying into this idea that there will be a point at which we feel fully formed? Is adulthood an illusion? I think I expected that one day I would magically be a grown-up, and a certain confidence, wisdom, and fearlessness would be conferred upon me, as if the more candles I blew out, the less I'd second-guess myself. Do you know how often I walk away from an exchange feeling like it went exactly as I'd hoped and I left a stellar impression? No times. It happened zero times. Yesterday, I tried to exit a coworker's car with my seatbelt still fastened. Embarrassed to find myself still in the seat, trapped like a turtle on its back, I undid the belt and stood up, only to launch my cell phone, which had been loose on my lap, into the gutter. That's the kind of suavity I'm working with. But if you think this means I'll be using any sort of landline to conduct my affairs, you're sorely mistaken. Better go email my mom to ask for advice. So for those of you who might know me from my time on the Adam Carolla show and remember the early days of the show, the coworker whose car I became trapped in when I tried to exit without taking off my seatbelt and then launched my cell phone, that was Donnie. And also this idea of when do you magically feel like an adult? I've been an adult long enough to feel like one. And I noticed every birthday for like a number of years in a row, I would wake up and I would think, I am too old to walk around feeling this insecure. I need to just get over that. But unfortunately, I don't think it's something you just choose to get over. So I have a new way of thinking about it, which is I think at some point you just decide, I am now an adult. And I am going to conduct myself like an adult. And I'm realizing as I'm talking that it sounds like those two things I just said contradict each other, because on the one hand, I just said you can't decide to be less insecure. And then I said I have decided to just be an adult. I guess you're just going to have to deal with that. No, to me, there is a distinction, because one is like getting rid of an anxiety, which I think it's hard to make a choice to get rid of an anxiety. And the other one is sort of just accepting that you are an adult and you have permission, not that you need permission, but you can be an adult in the world. Look, if this doesn't make sense, it's obviously because you're just too immature. I'm going to move on now. The Impending Chrismopolypse. And the illustration for this one is our fireplace, and there are two stockings hanging above it. One of them says Daniel, and the other one is just a sock. When I was little, I vowed not to become one of those people who dreads the holidays. One of those people, like my parents, who grimaces at the sound of Bing Crosby and grumbles at the sight of dirigible Santas and oversized candy canes being inflated on rooftops in October, and who seems to age many years over the course of one gift-buying season. The notion of being relieved that the holidays are over was as foreign to me as disliking Sesame Street or liking cilantro. My little brain just couldn't make sense of it. Instead, I loved every part of the season, from the advent calendars with their waxy chocolate, to the glittery crafts and dried macaroni wreaths coated in gold paint, to the sappy songs we'd memorize for the school pageant, an event held in the gymnasium at night. Just seeing a place at night I'd only ever seen during the daytime was thrilling enough. But factor in the tights, patent leather shoes, clip-on earrings, and blue eyeshadow my mom let me wear, accoutrements fit for a 1940s stripper, and I felt like I'd won some kind of Yuletide lottery. The excitement only intensified as the big day drew near. I was like a tiny holiday crack addict, and each successive sight and smell was another electrifying dose. Eggnog? Yes, please. Tinsel? I love tinsel. Christmas cookies? Must eat cookies. Fake snow? Yes. Picture with Santa? Yes. Not even sitting on the lap of a sweaty, handsy alcoholic in itchy polyester could dampen my spirits. By the time promos for How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Frosty the Snowman came on TV, I had butterflies in my stomach and was short of breath. How I'd ever get to sleep on Christmas Eve was beyond me. But somehow, slowly and possibly, the time would pass, and by about 4:30 or 5 a.m. I'd wake up and then force myself to stay in bed for as long as possible, another 15 minutes tops. When I could no longer take it, I'd scramble out of bed, grab the stockings from the living room, and wake up my little sister, and we'd sit in bed reading magazines and eating candy and playing with our collectible holiday pencils. It was a bunch of crap. Under the tree was where the real treasures lay, but we loved it. At some point, I lost the holiday spirit in a very big way. I'm not sure when or why, but I'm now that grumpy adult I never wanted to be, counting down the minutes until this ridiculously ornate, pine-scented charade is over and real life can resume. What's that, you say? You finished all your shopping early? I hate you in a very real, very frightening, white-hot, burning, all-caps kind of way. Hate. That was a hate in all caps, in case that didn't come through in my vocalizing of the word, my vocalization of the word, if you will. I still enjoy the songs, sort of, and the treats, although I fear the calories, but mostly I just feel enervated by the expectations and the crowds and the forced merriment. My boyfriend is the keeper of holiday spirit in our house, and if it weren't for him, I don't know that we would have even gotten a tree. Going out into the cold and selecting one, tying it to the roof of the car, dragging it up the steps, getting needles everywhere, and then having to deal with the hassle of getting rid of it a few weeks later just seems like a pain. And I don't know that I would do the whole gift exchange, battling the crowds and paying top dollar for something that will go on sale one day after Christmas, not even knowing whether what you're buying is what the person wants, and wrapping and measuring and cutting and taping and tying bows and making out cards all seems like a pain. And the dinner with all the dirty dishes and the parties with the mind-numbing, soul-deadening small talk. No thank you. But I hate that I feel this way, and I hate that I wish I could climb into bed and hide until mid-January. I'm trying my hardest to snap out of it, so at least I don't bring others down. But underneath it all, I desperately wish I could feel the happiness and excitement I felt as a kid. Am I alone with my spiritual stocking full of coal? Let me know how you're feeling about the impending Chrismopolypse and what you're doing to cope. Maybe we can pool survival strategies and get through it together. Unless you're the type who finished all your shopping months ago because you do it year-round, you'll just make the rest of us feel bad. I will say, I think I've gotten more in the Christmas spirit now that we're a few years out from this. That was probably like the height of my grinchiness, and now, especially now that I have a baby, who granted is way too young to get what Christmas is, but I'm more excited about it. And currently in LA, it's winter and it is hot as hell. And I did some writing, which you will hear soon, on how I feel about hot weather. But it feels like the opposite of Christmas right now. Not that it ever gets super Christmassy in California, but it gets a little more Christmassy than this. And I cannot wait for it to be Christmassy. So I have some sad news to report, and I have been wondering how to deal with it in this audiobook. A lot of the stories, including the one that you're about to hear, are about Oliver, who was our puppy that we treated like our son. He was the best dog in the world, and I documented a lot of his life in this column because he had a huge impact on us. And unfortunately, he is no longer with us. It was awful. When we were on our honeymoon, he was attacked by an off-leash dog, and then they thought he was going to make it, took him to the vet. He had an underlying kidney problem that we didn't know about, and he did not make it. And it was awful. So I don't want to be a gigantic bummer, but at the same time, I feel like I need to be upfront about all of these stories that you're about to hear. They are about the sweetest, best dog in the world, and I'm still fairly wrecked by the whole thing. But in rereading these stories, I'm remembering things that I had forgotten, and it's really bringing him to life for me. So I hope that I can share a bit of how special Oliver was with you guys. Puppy. And the illustration for this one is Oliver as a puppy. My boyfriend and I recently brought home a puppy, which means we said goodbye to sleeping, leaving the house unless it's absolutely necessary, taking a step without looking down, having a home that's decorated with anything other than squeaky rubber toys, the blissful ignorance that comes from not knowing what a bully stick is, and owning a remote control with an uneaten number 4 button. Though this is fine because we no longer have the time or attention span to watch TV. We've also bid adieu to romance for the most part. Yesterday, as Daniel was leaving for work and I was about to get in the shower, he popped his head in, appraised my state of undress, something that formerly would have given him pause, and yelled, with the fervor of someone whose sports team won, "He pooped!" I wish I could say I'd reached similar heights of ecstasy over the dog's bowel function, but I was too busy trying to get out of the shower as fast as humanly possible, for fear of where and in what state I'd find the tiny, adorable beast when I got out. Have you ever implored the water to come out of the nozzle faster? I feel like I'm suddenly in a race against the clock, and everything is conspiring to slow me down. I'm beginning to understand why new mothers opt for no-nonsense hairstyles. I no longer care whether I'm frizz-free, or whether my eyeliner tips up perfectly at the outer corners of my eyes, or whether my clothes are covered in puppy fur. I've accepted that when I walk into a room, people wonder why it smells like snossages. I have more important things to manage, namely, keeping this helpless attention whore alive. And that right there, the overwhelming, unrelenting sense of responsibility, is the part I hadn't quite anticipated. Since bringing home this tiny puppy, all ears and paws and wagging tail, that loves to have his belly rubbed, sits on command, and also sits when I try to take him for a walk, I feel like there's a pot on the stove about to boil over, or, and this may only resonate with some of you, as if I've left my straightening iron plugged in. At all times, there's a Rolodex of ways he could hurt himself flashing through my mind. Whenever I find that he's fine, curled up in his bed with his head resting on his giraffe toy, I feel like we've narrowly escaped some inevitable misfortune. It's exhausting. I realize it might seem offensive to suggest the experience of having a new puppy is anywhere close to that of having a new baby. I don't mean to suggest it's the same. I mean to suggest it's worse. With a baby, you get 9 months to prepare. Not only that, you can rely on your maternal or paternal instincts. With a puppy, those instincts kick in, but you have to override them and then try to think like a dog instead of a human. This is why I spent the morning rooting through the trash before walking through my food. This afternoon, I plan to eat a Kleenex, and then, if things break my way, lick some freshly applied lotion. Depending on my mood, I might whine. Well-meaning people tried to tell us, you should get an adult dog. Have you considered an adult dog? The short answer is we wanted the cuteness of a puppy. The even shorter answer is we were stupid. But as much as I say that I've learned my lesson, I suspect I will be in the same position again someday, because the memory of agony is very short, but the adorable pictures, of which I've taken a million, last forever. So, one day, when I no longer smell like Alpo and have had a full night of sleep, I will probably be foolish enough to think it's a good idea to get another puppy. If I do, please say no to me in a calm, assertive way. Now, if you'll excuse me, these zippers aren't going to eat themselves. So, a couple things I wanted to say. When I made reference to leaving your straightening iron plugged in, it occurred to me what I really mean is leaving your straightening iron on. Because I think if you leave your straightening iron plugged in, but it's turned off, your house is not going to burn down. I don't have any degrees in electricianry, but that just seems to be how it works to me. However, I find that when I mean to say leaving your straightening iron on, I always say or write, and by the way, I realize I'm painting a picture of myself as someone who talks exclusively about her straightening iron, which is not inaccurate. I tend to always say leaving your straightening iron plugged in, I think because I feel like it just communicates a more distinct image, sort of like when people are pantomiming rolling down a car window, they do the crank, even though you haven't needed to manually roll down a car window in, I don't know how many, I've lost track, it's been so many years, probably many hundreds of years, which is a long time, year-wise. And then the other thing I wanted to say is this idea that having, that this idea that I had, I said that like, this idea that this person put out there, this insane person that was me, this idea I had that somehow having a puppy was more challenging than having a baby, it turns out I was wrong. And how? All right then. The soft-spoken bridezilla. The illustration of this one is some kind of reptilian creature's hand with a ring on it and like a little flower around one of the claws, like in a matrimonial sort of reptilian way. It's probably Godzilla, come to think of it. If I appear dazed, helpless, and possibly in need of medical attention, as if I've just escaped captivity, please forgive me. It's just that I've been talking about weddings with my mother. I don't mean to sound like an ingrate, and I do love the woman, but she and I have vastly different philosophies on how to spend our time and money. For example, I like to avoid fruitless missions. She loves them. Or at least it would seem that way, given the nature of most of our conversations regarding the impending nuptials about which nothing has been decided. I can't remember her exact words. At a certain point, I have to tune out for self-preservation. The gist is always that she was talking to person I don't know, who has some very tenuous connection to matrimony, who suggested I do something that sounds like nothing I want any part of. Here's an example. I was talking to Karen. You remember Karen, right? Oh, you don't? Well, she has a niece who just got married, but her niece's boss's sister, Darlene, has been to tons of weddings. Why don't you call Darlene? I bet she has a lot of wedding ideas. Talking to someone who's been to a lot of weddings to get wedding ideas is like talking to someone who's had a lot of surgery to learn how to perform a heart transplant. And if I seem grave or intense, it's just that I keep panicking when I hear the average wedding costs $28,000, and yet my dream of the perfect wedding has never included the words BYOB or potluck. Plus, I've just never really enjoyed talking about weddings in general. I'm neither a tomboy nor emotionally dead inside. I love puppies and romantic comedies, and the silliest things make me cry. But I seem to be missing that very girly gene that allows one to brighten at the sight of lace, fall in love with table linens, and care whether things are tented or not. When I was about 4 years old, I had a clear vision of what I thought a wedding was. You'd walk down a long greenish hallway wearing a white dress, and there would be a line of men in tuxedos from which you'd select your husband. Not only did this vision avoid any wedding planning, but I also think I invented the bachelorette. Enjoy this time of life, more than one of my parents' friends has said in cards they've sent to my fiancé and me. You know who loves weddings more than the bride and groom? Your parents' friends. I didn't even realize getting engaged is cause for a card, but it is. And it's not like they're taking those sad blank cards with the generic images of flowers on the front and writing engagement wishes inside. They are shopping in the engagement card aisle. There are cards intended for this very purpose. It's making me wish I could do more cherishing and savoring than worrying and grumbling. The thing is, despite my foul attitude, I'm very much in love with my fiancé, and I'm excited about our life together. This has nothing to do with him, and everything to do with the fact that planning a wedding combines three of my least favorite things: planning, making decisions, and fashion. I am an indecisive person who hates shopping and waits until the very last minute to commit to plans. And yet, I don't want to elope. I thought I might as a way to avoid what feels like the world's frilliest scavenger hunt, but the more cards I put up on the refrigerator, the more I think I really do want the big ceremony. I like things that are lovely and nice and beautiful. I just don't know how to make them that way. And while I don't want to be involved in every decision, I also don't really trust anyone else to make the decisions for me. I just had an awful realization. I'm a bridezilla. I'm a soft-spoken, indecisive bridezilla who makes fart jokes and seems easygoing, but is secretly a tyrant. Given this unpleasant revelation, I'd like to go ahead and apologize preemptively to everyone around me, including my parents, siblings, friends, parents' friends, co-workers, fiancé, and fiancé's family. And I may as well apologize to you, too, because I fear I may have to drag you along with me like tiny wedding hostages. If it's any consolation, the maid of honor is making her fantastic macaroni and cheese. Could you bring napkins and ice? In retrospect, I do kind of wish I had eloped. But I bet if I had eloped, I would always have wished that I had the big, frilly wedding. So, I don't know. Kids, dogs, and puppies. And the illustration here is Oliver next to a baby. This is from a photo of Oliver next to a friend's baby. Fun fact, as I record this, Daniel and our son Elliot are visiting these friends whom this picture is of. I don't even know if grammatically that was correct, but please appreciate my attempt at whom. And there's a lot of illustrations of Oliver in this book, but I think this one, the one that goes with kids, dogs, and puppies, is the one that looks the most like him. And it is super cute. And it's making me sad and happy at the same time. Walking a puppy is a lot like walking a Kardashian. You can't go very fast, strangers stop you repeatedly, and the conversation isn't very stimulating. In the case of the puppy, this is how it goes down. From a short distance, approaching strangers will slow to a standstill and begin to ooh and ah. There will be nudging and pointing, followed by some debate about whether they are looking at a puppy or just a small, uncoordinated dog. Perhaps they've been burned before. By the time they've determined it is indeed a puppy, the initial spotter will have made sure all members of the party, spouses, children, dogs, are aware of the approaching visitor. "See the baby? Do you see the baby? Look, Riley, a baby!" one woman cooed to her disinterested puggle. Poor Riley wanted to continue his walk, but his owner didn't get it. It was like watching someone repeatedly say to a carrot, "Look, carrot, a baby carrot!" and expect to get a reaction. This notion that dogs would be anywhere near as excited as we are by smaller, younger, less well-behaved versions of themselves is a curious one. Children, on the other hand, do have a reaction. Fear. More than once, I felt like a guilty accomplice when parents invite the bouncy, adorable, uncontrolled ball of energy on the other end of the leash to terrorize their children. They mistakenly assume their kids are having the same... Okay, and the following words are all in caps and there's a period after each word. Oh, my, God, so cute, so little, must... snuggle, puppy, now, give me that puppy, 4 exclamation points, reaction they're having. So they're always confused when their kids become distraught or pull away. It's a matter of scale, of course. And what's silly, floppy, and no bigger than a desert boot to us is much larger, scarier, and unpredictable to a child. Plus, what we find irresistible and fun doesn't always translate, which is why I'm still angry at my mom for surprising me with a clown at my 6th birthday party. Did she intend to consign me to a lifetime of bozophobia? Bozophobia is not the real name. The real name for fear of clowns is coulrophobia, but bozophobia is funnier to say. Just thinking about JoJo's weird red yarn hair, the equivalent of clown cornrows, and oversized rubber shoes is enough to make me sweat. But back to the streets. Here's the thing about the way kids and dogs react. I think they might be right. We're the ones who are so distracted by cuteness that we're willing to forgive everything else. Kids and dogs look past the pleading eyes and wagging tail into the dark heart of the beast. Do I think my puppy is out to get me? Of course not, but he'd gladly knife me for some string cheese if his paws could work a blade. I'm not saying he's evil. He's just out for himself, like a reality show contestant or someone who loves the Fountainhead. But that thing where he walks through his food and then jumps in your lap and puts his messy paws on your face, I'm pretty sure that's the dog equivalent of waiting until you pass out at a party to write on your face with a Sharpie. And then there are the times he bites the ottoman while looking up at you when he wants attention, or plays a version of fetch where you end up throwing and retrieving the toy, or gets a sudden surge of energy when he manages to snag something that isn't his, as if he were Pac-Man and a dirty sock were a power pellet. Actually, maybe he really is evil, but not in an invade Poland kind of way, more in a jackass kind of way. He's like a misbehaving drunk teenager. Or Lindsay Lohan. He gets away with his shenanigans because he's so cute and was in Herbie Fully Loaded. Plus, it's always possible he just doesn't know any better. These are the options. He's either a good-natured simpleton or a manipulative genius that loves cheese. When he finds and pulls all the stuffed squirrels out of his puzzle toy, I think he's a genius. When he shoves his head inside the toy and gets stuck and walks into furniture, I'm less sure. I should give him a drug test just to be safe. His, Mine, and Ours. And the illustration to this one is a vacuum cleaner. I recently did something very loving, tender, romantic, and kind-hearted. I walked from room to room in the apartment I share with my fiancé, trying to figure out who's ruined more of whose stuff. It started innocently enough. One afternoon, he announced it was time to purchase new blue jeans. Like so many of us, he'd been wearing the same few pairs long enough that they'd become comfortable, which is nature's way of telling you they're no longer in style. The following morning, he waltzed out the door in soft, faded Levi's, and then returned in super-saturated dark blue skinny jeans, struggling to move. "I'm a skinny jeans guy now," he declared, teetering. He hobbled to the couch and then fell on it. This is how he sits now. I didn't think much of it. If he wants to muffin-top his ankles, that's his business. But then I started noticing something strange. Half of our, and by our I mean my, beige couch was turning gray. At first I assumed it was some weird butt-shaped shadow. But the more I inspected it, the more I realized the dark cloud was on the fabric itself. I struggled to identify the culprit. Newsprint? Cigar smoke? Soot? Had someone been entertaining an erudite cigar-smoking chimney sweep behind my back? It seemed unlikely. But then I heard my beloved gasping for breath from the other room. Of course! His jeans were leaking! I informed Skinny Jeans that his new personality was leaving a mark all over my, I mean our, furniture, and that he might want to consider dropping the new duds in the wash. A look of panic flashed across his face. I felt bad because I knew I was asking him to risk shrinkage, which would mean him having to wake up a good 60 minutes earlier to get dressed. But as far as I could tell, we only had two options: shrink the skinny jeans, or invite the California Raisins over to rub themselves on the couch to even out the tone. Then I began to wonder whether he was wiping his blue butt all over my couch in retaliation for crimes I'd committed against his pillowcases early in our relationship. Allow me to explain. I am a grown woman in many ways, age being the main one, but I still have the skin of a teenager. Her name was Cheryl. Because I still break out, I often slather on acne cream before bed, which works to control and cure breakouts, repel the opposite sex, and bleach the bejesus out of any fabric with which it comes in contact. I learned this the hard way when Daniel asked why his eyes burned when he hugged me and why his blue pillowcases were streaked with orange. I went on to destroy his blue face towels and white bath sheets with mascara and lipstick. I also damaged his vacuum. While vacuuming, I went around a corner, which accidentally yanked the cord from the wall and bent the prongs, and the plastic. But who's really keeping track? I mean, aside from me. The vacuum had it coming because it beguiled me with its handy wand attachment, which is coiled and stuffed into the back of the vacuum, ready to strike. I had no idea that if I released the wand from its holster, I would not only suddenly feel as if I were battling an angry robot, but also never be able to stuff it back into the machine without first learning origami. It's right up there with cheap horizontal blinds in terms of flimsy pieces of plastic with a deeply ingrained sense of individualism. So, one could say we're even. And yet, I still think the couch offense is bigger, simply because the couch is larger. And because it's mine. I'm left with two questions. At what point will I stop thinking of our belongings as his or mine and just think of them as ours? And if I rub my face on his skinny jeans, will I bleach his jeans or will my face turn blue? I'm going to find out. Worst case scenario, I'll become a chimney sweep. So, to bring you up to date on this, we've now been married a few years, and I still think of some of our belongings as separate. However, stuff like the utensils, which were his, I think of as ours. Exciting purchases we've made together, like, you know, a portable fan, let's say, that's ours. But I think the furniture I still kind of think of as his and mine. And by that I mean mine. The fearlessness of youth and puppies. And this is a picture of Oliver wearing an Evel Knievel jacket. My fiancé... Okay, I must interrupt myself to say there's something so irritating about someone who is constantly referring to their fiancé. My fiancé! My fiancé! My fiancé! We get it! Someone has agreed to marry you! Kudos! So, for the time that he was my fiancé, I usually referred to him as my boyfriend, except, it seems, in this column. I think because it was weekly and I didn't think someone was going to be reading all of them like in one fell swoop. So apologies for the relentless fiancéing that is happening to your eardrums. My fiancé's least favorite part of walking our new puppy, Oliver, isn't tripping over the leash, carrying around a bag of hot poop, or trying to stop him from putting anything and everything, including cigarette butts, snails, and dirt clods, into his little mouth. It's when strangers ask him what the puppy's name is. Daniel is hesitant to answer, as he worries it might somehow lead to Oliver being dognapped. I think it's cute he's under the impression Oliver knows his own name. Because I am a woman of science, and because I'm a little bored, I tested my theory that Oliver would answer to basically any name if it were delivered in an enthusiastic, chirpy, I may or may not have a treat for you tone of voice. The tone of voice you'd use when praising a 5-year-old or a very drunk 25-year-old for tying his shoes. As predicted, Oliver responded to each of the top 10 hottest baby names of 2013, even Mavis. And while I am in favor of Daniel's protective instinct, I'm unclear how knowing Oliver's name would make it easier to dognap him. It's not as if Oliver's in the habit of demanding a name. He's little and sometimes annoying, but other than that, he's nothing like Rumpelstiltskin. The thing that Daniel's rightly keying into is Oliver's complete trust and faith in the world around him. He's the friendliest furball we've ever met, and if someone were trying to attack me or steal him, he'd lick that person's face. He'd drive the getaway car if he thought he could get string cheese out of it. But what Oliver, if that is his real name, lacks in normal canine qualities, like loyalty, obedience, and house training, he more than makes up for in adorableness and fearlessness. It's not just that he isn't afraid of strangers. He isn't afraid of anything. The only experience that's ever given him pause was his first exposure to a noisy vacuum cleaner. But even that he got over quickly. He hid under the coffee table for a few minutes before snorting, as if to announce he would be making a grand entrance. He then emerged from the table, walked slowly over to the appliance, and started humping it. I'm told the humping isn't sexual at this age. It's about dominance and play. I admire the way he's literally trying to conquer his fears. I often wish I were more like Oliver, that I could just chase down my fears and try to have sex with them. Instead, I'm cautious and fearful, analytical when I should be carefree. Instead of living life and enjoying it, I scan the room to make sure everything is okay. I've always been this way. I can remember staying after school with my teacher and my mom in second grade. Together, the two women were going to try to help me over my fear of the jungle gym by giving me all the time I needed, away from my peers, to climb and hang and swing and perhaps even do a flip off the bars one day, just like the other kids. I showed those two dreamers by slipping and knocking out a tooth. Granted, it was a baby tooth, and they're meant to come out, but there was a lot of blood and a lot of sand. Is there anything more disgusting and more reminiscent of childhood than a mouthful of hot, bloody sand? I've always lacked coordination, which is why I'm afraid of things that require it. Or maybe it's the other way around. I'm uncoordinated because I'm afraid. But the point is, I'm afraid of things I'm not good at, and I'm not afraid of things I am good at. Public speaking? No problem. Parasailing? I'd rather stay here on firm, dry land. My parents are similarly fearful, and despite their best intentions to impart an adventurous, lion-hearted warrior spirit on their daughters, they instead passed along hay fever, cautiousness, and birthing hips. For this reason, I've decided to have Oliver raise my children. Don't tell Daniel. So after Oliver, we got a dog named Wendy, and she is kind of the opposite of Oliver. She's afraid of everything. And Oliver never barked. She barked. Oliver was very outgoing. You'd be walking him, and he was so cute that people always wanted to come up. So someone would come up and be like, oh, how cute. And then the next thing they knew, they'd be holding him because he would, like, kind of climb up them and jump into their arms. Wendy, who's now 3.5, I think, she's making progress. Like, she's a little more adventurous when she's on walks and she's interested in people and goes up and wants them to pet her. But it's been a long time coming. Her natural Wendy self is to be more nervous and anxious, I think. How I feel about your bathroom scale. The illustration for this one is a scale, and it has a 10-pound weight sitting on it, and then the readout says ERR, like error. Whenever I walk into someone's guest bathroom for the first time and see a scale sitting out, in case guests should want to weigh themselves during a dinner party, one assumes, I reflect on the way I would never, ever casually step on another woman's scale, certainly not without the proper emotional preparation, and definitely not after any sort of salty hors d'oeuvres. Then, while slowly backing away from the scale and making a cross with my fingers, I become envious of the casual and easy relationship with weight I imagine other people must have. Let's just have a look-see, I picture them saying before hopping onto the scale, probably with their shoes on. These kinds of people only ever gain or lose 0.5 pound. They could weigh themselves immediately following Thanksgiving dinner, with a Tupperware full of leftovers in one hand and a cinder block in the other, and their weight would be the same, give or take 0.5 pound. I merely look at yams and gain 10 pounds. This is why my relationship with the scale is much more complicated. At any given time, my scale, which I've had for about 10 years, is in one of three places. It's in its usual spot in the bathroom, where I will be tempted to step on it at regular intervals, like a nervous homeowner repeatedly checking the locks. On its side behind some towels, when I fear the number will be discouraging and I don't want to debate weighing myself every time I see it. Or under the bed in another room, when it's been bad and needs a timeout. I've recently developed a fourth place, by the way, which is in the bathtub. Empty bathtub. And when I do step on it, I don't do so lightly, no pun intended. I rip off every possible article of clothing and jewelry, if I could temporarily donate a kidney I would, and then mount the scale with the solemnity of someone entering a confessional. I close my eyes, hold my breath, say a quick prayer, and then look down. If I sound neurotic, which I do and which I am, it's because my weight has been up and down, usually more up than down, for many years of my life. Though I've managed to maintain a decent weight loss for a while now, I'm convinced those 40 pounds are waiting for the chance, plotting, really, to snap back onto my body. To this end, I torture myself thinking at all times about what I'm putting in my mouth, what I'm going to be putting in my mouth, or what I already put in my mouth. I recently had one of those weeks where I thought it best to avoid the scale, as I knew it would only lead to a bad mood. Instead, I told myself I would diet and exercise and then weigh myself in a few days. But as always happens, at a certain point, I became convinced that by giving myself a break from the internal hectoring, I was allowing those pounds to creep back on. And so, I just had to get on the scale and live in reality, even if it's a reality in which I'd gained 20 pounds in 3 days. I gave myself an insane pep talk and hopped on to discover I'd lost a pound. This was impossible. Instead of feeling relief, I was convinced the scale was broken and that it had probably been broken for years. Who knows how long this generous scale had been blowing smoke up my butt? I set off to find things around the house that I could weigh to test its accuracy. I started with 2 cartons of milk. The scale didn't register them at all, which had me convinced it's at least 2 cartons of milk short. I tried to weigh my 6-pound puppy, but he was too squirmy. Then I remembered my fiancé has some dumbbells. I placed 2 10-pound weights on the scale, 19 pounds. I did this repeatedly, relieved the scale was only 1 pound off. But any comfort I experienced soon gave way to panic when it occurred to me that perhaps the scale was off 1 pound for every 20 pounds. How would I know? I discussed the matter with my fiancé, who suggested that I just put another 20 pounds on the scale. The good news is the scale wasn't broken. The bad news is it is now, because one of the weights slipped out of my hand and crashed onto it, cracking the readout. Or maybe that's the good news. So I am well aware that my relationship with the scale is dysfunctional. It's not healthy. I've gone through periods of time where I am convinced that I should just give up my weighing myself all the time habit. And I have done that successfully in terms of like, oh, I haven't weighed myself for a while, but I don't know that it led to more sanity. And also, all of this was before I got pregnant and gained a whole bunch of pregnancy pounds, which I am in the process of losing. I just have a little bit left. But that is me disclosing more information than you need to know because I am neurotic when it comes to weight and scales. Okay, then.
On Being a Woman in Comedy and Podcasting. And the illustration of this one is a map that shows Montenegro, and then there are a few cities pointed out, and it's Schnauzelberg, Snoutvik, Nostrovenia, and Hugebeek. Hugebeek with an umlaut over the E. I'm often asked what it's like to be a woman in the male-dominated fields of comedy and podcasting. This question, like, what is your favorite movie? Or why didn't you call me back? Isn't very fun to answer, which is why I usually don't. That's a good question, I'll say, as if an opportunity to ruminate and expound were a gift seldom bestowed upon me. Then I'll pause thoughtfully for a moment, point to something that isn't there, shriek and slide under the table until the subject changes. I realize I'm part of the problem with my disingenuous answer. Here's a tip. If you ask a question that's greeted with, good question, it's not a good question. I know this seems counterintuitive, and I, too, have fallen for it. Look at me asking the tough questions like a regular Barbara Walters or Kermit the Frog newsflash I've crowed to myself upon having my question complimented. In fact, so enamored was I of my own inquisitiveness that I didn't even notice whether the question was being answered. But back to the one I'm currently not answering. I can only dodge it so many times, and lately it's been coming up with such frequency that I finally decided to address it. With the exception of the times a baby has unexpectedly shot out of my vagina and/or I've had to leave the stage to check on a souffle, I'd say that my experience isn't all that different from a man's. Yes, I only receive 77% of each laugh, and sure, I've been told that with a tan and a nose job I'd be, quote, good to go. But that's just because I'm unfunny and pale, and I have a nose the size of Montenegro.
I don't see it when I look in the mirror, but someone said it on YouTube, so it must be true. Now, I know what you're thinking. Montenegro isn't even that big. And you're right. For a country, it's very small, but for a nose, it's big. As for the issue of whether there are more funny men or more funny women, I literally can't answer, what with not being good at math and always having bonbons in my mouth. Fun fact, bonbons is not what I originally wrote. Originally, it was a little more blue. In terms of material, women are free to do many of the same subjects as men, so long as they never talk about their personal lives, struggles to find a mate, weight, menstruation, insecurities, or if they have them, children. These topics are considered too hacky, and the last thing you want to be is hacky, unless you're ugly, in which case ugly is the last thing you want to be. In order of things you don't want to be, fat, hacky, ugly, smelly, angry. Instead, why not pick a few traits from the following list? Nice, floral, breakfasty, thoughtful, booby, cute, gluten-free, petite, maternal, perky, Kate Upton-like, serene, or hairless, exception hair on the head. Who wouldn't laugh at a hairless, gluten-free, booby comedian doing jokes about something completely gender-neutral that affects us all, like itchy balls? As for my process, I imagine it's no different than a guy's, except that for 1 week a month I retire to a special Wi-Fi-enabled hut where I attempt to be funny in between crying jags. During this time, I also light scented candles, scrapbook, and yell at everyone. So those are my silly little thoughts on what it's like to be a woman working in a male-dominated field. But if you really want to know, you should probably ask a man, because all this thinking has tired me out. The question I think people are really getting at when they ask me about my experience is, why aren't there more women in these fields? There are a lot, to be sure, probably more now than ever. But the perception is that comedy and podcasting are still heavily male, and I do have some thoughts about that. While I believe both sexes are equally capable of humor, it's historically been less socially acceptable for a woman to be funny, because humor, even the most benign, most self-deprecating humor, still has a scintilla of aggression, and women are encouraged to be gentle and agreeable. A woman who's funny, who shows that kind of messy, electrifying, sometimes combative engagement with the world, will be given a bit of a wider berth. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to crawl under the table. I guess I don't really have much to say about all of that, except in reading it, I read it and I go, oh, I sound angry. I don't think it's an angry piece, but I think that I was a bit angry. I think maybe I am a bit angry just about, women in comedy and podcasting, I guess. It's getting hot, so I'm moving to Antarctica. And the illustration for this one is me on a chaise lounge on the beach. There's a palm tree in the background. And you see the chaise lounge from the back. You see that kind of chair. And then you see the back of a person who's wearing a big furry coat and a furry hat with a pom-pom on it, drinking a tropical drink. It's now that time of year when it goes from slightly warm to, holy hell, I think I'm sitting on the face of the sun overnight, which is excellent news for the 1% of us who enjoy their upper arms, and a natural disaster for the rest of us. Listen, you Gwyneths in your sleeveless tunics and your spaghetti-strapped sundresses and, worst of all, your blouses with cap sleeves that make my white noodles look like the beginning of a balloon animal. All of you can go confidently hail a cab into the ocean. My former coworker who looked forward to summer because she was, quote, allergic to sleeves, can be your driver. You're ruining it for the rest of us with your cocoa-buttered, bronze-sculpted limbs that are the same size whether they are pressed against your body or you're reaching unself-consciously for something on a high shelf. You're the kind of nightmares who could probably be wearing a short t-shirt, reach up to smooth your perfect hair, and then put your arm down without worrying you just exposed the shocking white ripple of albino muffin top. You disgust me. I can barely go from seated to standing without having to readjust everything. The appropriate reaction to Mercury rising is dread and anxiety. The weather is not your friend, or if it is, it's that friend who accidentally tells everyone your most unflattering secrets, which in this case are flabby arms, thighs that stick together, and my upper lip's tendency to form beads of sweat and frizz. Oh, and the fact that when I'm warm, my face flushes and turns red, especially my nose. Why couldn't we be trending toward global cooling? I could get behind that. I very nearly wore a tank top to therapy yesterday because it was so hot that the part of my brain that